Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's July 17th, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or you can find me hanging out at overthecap.com. Back to the nighttime recording this week, so we're back to kind of normal here at home. So we've got Nelly back. Hey, Nelly, you got anything this week? Nothing from Nelly. But I'm sure she'll make some noise during this podcast since she's made her way back down here instead of being upstairs in the event that there was some flooding. She is back to be entertained during this. Got the Michelob Ultra beer, water, or whatever you want to call it. Still going on for a little bit of time. Eventually we will get back to something a little bit more ambitious than the Michelob Ultras here. I'm not sure if we'll continue this until I go on vacation later in August or a little bit before that. We'll see. But then I think we'll be open to some beer suggestions for during the season. And I think what we'll do is, I'll try to get some suggestions for stuff that they have in the area. Maybe I'll send out a couple links to a couple of liquor stores that we have around here. You guys have some thoughts for me. Give them a shot during the podcast and I'll use them as I hopefully not suffer this year through Jets games, but we'll get some stuff for a Friday night or a Saturday night and then Sunday during the day. As we get to that, we're getting closer and closer to training camp. So that's a good thing because right now it is dead in the NFL. I was just thinking about it, like just how little news there is. There's just nothing really out there that's even too entertaining. You know, it's been a pretty bland offseason, I think, for the most part. So anyway, we'll start today with the big news about the franchise tag, which really wasn't much in the way of big news. We went over the players last week, and really there was no activity. I thought there would have been more of a push from the Jets for Marcus May. Sounds like they were far apart. They just weren't even close. You know, May is one of those players that he's not a franchise player. Sometimes teams use franchise tags on players who really aren't franchise players. You know, and when that happens, it's tough to come to an agreement sometimes because if you're putting it out that the player is a franchise player, your offers should, you know, represent that fact at least to some extent. And it sounds like the Jets just figured that this was a placeholder, which really isn't the reason to use it, but yeah, it is what it is. So they'll have an unhappy safety on their team this year, and I would imagine that he'll be gone next year. No deal for Allen Robinson. I'd imagine he'll be gone next year as well, because if you just run through the numbers, it really doesn't make sense to franchise tag him a second time. That makes zero sense at all. Probably doing an extension or a new contract next year probably doesn't make as much sense either, unless he develops a great relationship with Fields and the Bears have a good season to where they, you know, kind of change course and decide to keep him. I think this is pretty much it for him in Chicago, and so he'll get to try free agency next year. I think the problems there deal with a very bit of a wild wide receiver market. I think the Bears looked at Robinson as a player worth right around what he had been making. I'm sure Robinson looks at himself as a $20 million a year player. You do have a couple of big deals at wide receiver, but you also have a lot of players who really failed to cash in. So I think that was probably a hang up there. The only deal that does come down is the Taylor Moten contract in Carolina. I was a little surprised that that deal got done. That was one I discussed last week about how it was kind of, in a sense, going to be a validation on a big market jump that happened with the Ryan Ramczyk deal. And they come in and they do a deal that's reported at being worth around $18 million a year. It's actually worth about $17 million a year. It's just, typically, when a player is a franchise player, you value it as an entire contract. You don't value it as like new money. The initial reports went out as a new money deal. And the reason for that was simply because it sounded a little better. You know, it was close to $18 million a year if you looked at it that way. And you can value it that way if you want. You know, from his perspective, you can. It was kind of a concept that I talked about with the Cowboys and Dak Prescott last year. If you take this year as a given, like it's a sunk cost, right? You already put the franchise tag on him. You just kind of look at those new years as, well, what would that really be worth? The problem is just that that's not really the way that they're valued in the NFL. So if you're looking to hit certain types of metrics in reality, not in the quick Twitter world of reporting, you know, that makes it a little bit more difficult. So anyway, this is a deal that I think is important in the sense that I think it validates, and I'll talk about this a little bit now, the market itself. And, you know, there were some questions about that. And Mitchell Schwartz, the former right tackle for the Browns and the Chiefs. I think more known for his stint with the Chiefs and being a top right tackle in the NFL. You know, he was asking, they had a little discussion about it on Twitter. Why wouldn't you look at Ramczyk's deal as a legitimate contract? Like his point was, and it's a valid point, you've got Lane Johnson's deal. You had Trent Brown's deal. And those are two guys who played right tackle. Now you've got Ryan Ramczyk's deal. Like, doesn't Ramczyk completely validate it? Like, why do you need a second player to validate it? And the way that I always kind of look at outlier contracts, and everybody can have a different opinion of these things, you can have multiple outlier deals. I don't think that that's out of the realm of possibilities. You know, the thing when you get into kind of the economics, if you want to call it the economics of the NFL, or I guess any sport, it's almost like a game of chicken, right? When it comes to some of these contracts, when you're negotiating an extension with a player, you have to make an offer that's strong enough to say, hey, you shouldn't want to go to free agency. You know, this offer is going to, at the very least, match what you're going to get in free agency and take the risk off the table for you, because we're going to give you the injury guarantee. So if you suffer a devastating injury, you're taken care of. You know, that's one of the things. And then the second thing is that you have to read the market as a team to put a viable offer out there as to what you think the market would be. Now, a lot of times teams have vastly different opinions as to what that is. And I just talked about Marcus May and Allen Robinson, that there's probably a pretty big disconnect. But you can have multiple outliers, I think, at a position. And I know that's weird to say, but I think when you look at these things, you have to put things sometimes in perspective of those individual teams. So, you know, if I was dealing with the Raiders, for example, I think it's very reasonable, if you're a right tackle and you're dealing with the Raiders and Gruden is still there, you would go into that and say, hey, listen, you paid that last guy $16 million or $16.5 million to go and play right tackle. You guys think right tackle's that important, so you got to pay my guy. Philadelphia would be the same way. But I think around the league, you know, traditionally they've looked at right tackle as a low position. You know, I looked at the salaries of players, of the top players signed since, I think it was 2017. I'm not going to look up the actual numbers here, but I think the basics were that the left tackle position was around $17 million or $18 million, I think, per year was the value of the top players. Guard was next at about 13. Then you had center, I think, at 10.8, and then right tackle at 10.2. League-wide, they always looked at those two deals as just kind of, you know, out there. And if we look historically, I think you can find a lot of times where that's the case. You know, if you can paint it as a special situation, special players, special circumstance. You go back, Nnamdi Asamoah, back in 2009, I think he signed the deal that was worth probably 14 base, 16 actuality over like 3 years with the Raiders. You know, this was in the period where the Raiders were just atrocious with anything contract-wise. A couple of years later, Revis signed for $16 million. So you've got two corners that you can point to say $16 million. And those deals were done in 2009 and 2013, if I remember off the top of my head here. We didn't see a deal past that number until 2020, right? I think 2020 is when we actually passed those numbers. You go back at Larry Fitzgerald and Calvin Johnson. You know, they were in the $16 million range for wide receivers. Guys couldn't come close to that. You look at that year where Demaryius Thomas and Dez Bryant were free agents, and it was as if those deals, which were signed before, didn't exist. Adrian Peterson and Christopher Johnson. Yeah, it was like two very different players. It was like it didn't impact anyone else. And you would see it running back. Occasionally, you'd have a Marshawn Lynch jumped up there for that goofy two-year deal. Chiefs did a sort of extension for Jamal Charles that I guess you could have said was up there. I never looked at that one that way. You know, there were a couple deals that came in there, but they were always just kind of looked at as, eh, you know, it's very specific. And I think the right tackle ones fit into that category. All right, Lane Johnson was drafted to be a left tackle. Jason Peters was so good, never broke down and never became ridiculously expensive. They said, all right, we'll keep Lane Johnson. But if you understand the market dynamics, Lane Johnson is going to go to the market and he's going to say, hey, I'm a left tackle, and he's going to get paid like a left tackle. So it doesn't matter that he didn't play left tackle with the Eagles. It has to do with what his physical attributes are. The same thing with Brown. You know, Brown went into that. So he had played right tackle. It's not crazy to think of him as a right tackle, but he went into free agency as a left tackle. Teams were looking at him as a left tackle. Now, how hot the market was for him, I don't know. There were a lot of teams I knew that were very, very, very negative on him, more for just, I think, non-football kind of stuff, just weren't going to be interested in that. The Raiders read that, and probably right, that he was going to get paid as the top left tackle, whatever that number was going to be in free agency, and they had to come up with an offer that was going to entice him to sign there, even if they thought about moving him to the right side based on, you know, drafts and those kind of things. I think you can definitely have multiple outliers at a position as long as you can talk about those circumstances and you can come up with reasons for why that is. The Ramczyk one was harder for me to come up with, you know, but it's such a huge jump. You're talking about a jump where you've got the legitimate right tackle market at 14, and where we talked about those top 10 players at 10, and you're talking about a jump to 20. Yeah, you know, to 19, you know, just about to 20. So it's such a big jump, you know, that's like position busting territory. You know, we talk about those players, typically it's a position buster is someone who just is worth so much more than like fifth highest paid player or something like that. That's the first thing, you know, you jump into that and go, wow, you know, that guy's really great. Maybe he's going to pull up the market, but is he going to pull it up to that extent? The other one was you had the situation with New Orleans. And the situation with New Orleans is the fact that their left tackle is going to be a free agent next year. He's in his early 30s, I believe. The contract itself, with the exception of a all-pro incentive that dealt with just being at the left tackle side, which you could read two different ways, you know, makes you kind of wonder, is the plan going to be if they cannot sign Armstead to a reasonable contract, if their fallback plan is, well, we're going to move him to left tackle. And if he knows he's going to get moved to left tackle, he's going to ask for a fortune and we're going to have to pay him a fortune. So let's just get it out of the way, pay him the fortune now so we can function better this year. And we have a little bit more control over his contract over the next couple of years. He has an incentive in his deal, which is based on being all pro at left tackle. Again, you could look at that two ways. You could look at that as the Saints saying, well, you know, yeah, we plan on moving to left tackle. If in the event we keep you at right tackle, in a situation like the Raiders or something like that, or even the Eagles, we look at this as we already know you're a great right tackle. Look at how much money we're going to pay you if you stay at right tackle. You know, that's a hell of a lot of money, $19 million a year. It's a ridiculous amount of money for a right tackle. If you become all pro at right tackle, you're not getting extra money. But if we do move you to left tackle, we'll give you a way to get to $20 million a year. You know, or whatever the numbers take them up to. I can't recall off the top of my head. That's one of the ways to look at it. The other way to look at it is saying, well, they put that incentive in there because they just want to protect themselves in the event he moves to left tackle. You know, and there's an argument that could be said for, I think, that kind of reasoning with that deal as well, simply because there's other ways of boosting the salary if somebody moved from a right to the left side. And I couldn't remember who it was. You know, Brad had mentioned something on there, and I couldn't remember, and I'm too lazy to look it up. I think I'm going to lean towards three teams, the Vikings, the Eagles, and the Bengals. I'm going to lean towards the Eagles because the Eagles are the most creative team with their contracts and everything else. And this is probably back in like 2008, 2009, something like that. Maybe even before that. Could have been a little after. But basically, the contract was for a right tackle that maybe could move to the left side. And at least I think it was for a right tackle. It could have been for a guard. And basically what they did is they tied his paragraph 5 salary to the position he played. What that was that, okay, this is your right tackle salary or your guard salary. This is your left tackle salary. You know, that would be the more traditional way or the more reasonable way to do a right tackle to left tackle move. You know, so you would look at that and say with a guy like Ramczyk that the right way to have done that deal would have been $15 million per with escalators if he moved to left tackle. That would bump him to the 19 or 20. I think there were different reasons that you could look at that deal and say, okay, this is a real market deal or this is not. So then the next question is for the other 31 teams in the NFL, you know, or if we want to take the Raiders and the Eagles out of the equation, the question simply becomes now, do you believe that this fundamentally changes the approach of the other teams in the NFL? If we allow him to play on the franchise tag this year, and we're not going to tag him next year, and we're going to let him go to free agency, but we're still going to try to keep him. Do we believe in free agency that he's going to go out there and he's going to get an offer of $17, $18 million a season, or do we believe he's going to get you know, the offer that's more around 14 or 15? That's the question that you have to ask. When a deal impacts enough to where it's going to impact other players, you know, that's when the deals are kind of valid. That's when you know that the bidding changes. You know, when you see the cornerbacks, was it Tre'Davious White was the one that got to 17-2? You know, when you see that jump there, you're like, all right, you know what? If he's going to get to 17-2, well, yeah, that's pretty clear that someone's going to get to 19. Maybe someone's going to get to 20. You see it with the different positions. So I was uncertain on the Ramczyk deal. And this to me is the validation of it, because this is a lesser player. This is a player that I think is more comparable. And it's a situation that's very clear he's a right tackle. New Orleans, I think it's a pretty good situation that he's a right tackle as well. But I can make an argument for a lot of other stuff. This to me validates it. You know, this is the David Johnson to the Todd Gurley. Now, those happen right away. And I knew that those were going to happen kind of in tandem in a sense like that. To me, that this validates it. This is, okay, this is going to be your new market. I guess the question that you ask from this point on is, well, why did they agree to the deal then? You know, why didn't he get more money? Yeah, that's one thing, but I'm sure he's looking at this. You know, he just guaranteed himself an extra $29, $30 million. You know, he locked himself in on the New Year's at 18. You think about it. Was he going to go into free agency next year and get $18 million? Probably not. You know, maybe. He's doubtful he would get more than that. You know, you run a risk. You know, what happens if by next year, you know, the Vikings, who are really, really good front office, what happens if they go in there and they negotiate a deal for their right tackle that's $15 million a year? Well, you're not going to get 17 or 18 because now they're pushing back on that Ramczyk deal. What happens if the Saints in February pretty much announce Ramczyk's going to be a left tackle? Well, you got the ammunition to go back and say, see, we told you so. So this kind of takes that out of the equation. And I think now that you have a comparable player in there, along with the Saints player, you'll probably see a market jump for some of the other ones. But going back to, well, why does the deal then happen? And I think the important thing to look at here is the cash flows on this. The big hangup that I thought with the Ramczyk contract really had to do with the fact that the cash flows in that deal are outrageous. It would have made more sense at that point to franchise tag Moten two or even three times because of how high those numbers were for Ramczyk. You know, the tags would have been, what was he this year? 13.754. So you would have been at 30 million over 2 years. You know, if you did, you would have had at least another 24. You would have been at 54 over three. And those numbers are all less. Those numbers would all be less than the Ramczyk deal. And when you look at the numbers here, this is what the Panthers got out of this. They got a deal that in cash flow terms is kind of a market splitter, but with a lean towards the old market, not the Ramczyk numbers. While his money is going to be protected and he'll probably earn the 3 year 50, the numbers on the deal are in the first year he gets 16. So he gets a little bit of a raise over the franchise tag this year. Ramczyk, in terms of new money, will be at 28 in the first year. Conklin was at 20. So that's a big thing for the Panthers. It's not a major increase over their budget. They get more salary cap flexibility both this year and next. They brought a salary cap number down this year. They'll roll that over to next year, and they can maneuver his deal however they want instead of being locked into the franchise tag. Year two, his running cash total will be $32.2 million. That's, you know, decent for him. It's a little bit over two tags. Two tags would have been 30.26. This is 32. So it's kind of a nice little in-between that you have there. And again, this trends more towards Conklin's number. Ramczyk, 42. Conklin, 30. We've got the first 2 years of the deal, which oftentimes are some of the most important things that are there, and trends toward old market. Now you've got year three, and this is where he's got his turn. So he gets up to $50 million over 3 years. That's way over the 42 for Conklin. Now, Conklin's going to be a free agent so you get into all kinds of other things. But it basically split the market. 59 for Ramczyk, 50 for Moten, 42 for Conklin. You can see the logic here, in a sense, for Carolina. We got the 2 years with the salary cap flexibility, not much more than two franchise tags. Now, the important thing, you're under the three tag total, along with the flexibility. Plus, you do have outs, I think, at that point. Brad actually got these contract details on this one right away. Good for him. So he had put them out there. So let me just take a look. Yeah, he does have his 11 guaranteed that year. In theory, if things really, really go south, they could turn around and cut him on like an even cost. They're going to have to pay him 11. You know, that's a lot. So I doubt they would do it. So his 50 is pretty much locked in. But again, you know, that splits the market. Then you go into, I'm just in our player comp module here. So Conklin's deal is done after three. So now you've got the turn on this. You've got year four, where we've got 77 to 67.5 and then 96 to 85 over five. That's kind of, I think what you're going to see now is you're going to see deals that will come closer and closer to Ramczyk's numbers. But I think the cash flow numbers in those first 3 years will have a hard time meeting the Ramczyk one. They'll build off the Moten deal, which is kind of a bridge between the old and the new. And I think that's going to be the big thing. You know, he got a good signing bonus. It's about 18% of the contract. That's very close to what Ramczyk got on his. He's got a lot of roster bonuses in there, so that's good for him. You know, that's a lot of early decisions that the Panthers have to make. A lot of early money that he can earn. New guarantee, 43. You know, that's a little bit less than Ramczyk. Was it 48.5 on his new guarantee? Both got 43 full. Ramczyk got 60 injury protection. 19.2 to 17. Just looking at other stuff here. He got the same thing with the all-pro incentives. That's probably not very useful. Now, from his perspective, they're going to look to sell this a little bit different, this deal. They're going to look to sell this, if you look at this in terms of new money, they're going to look at this as 18.5 over 1, which is, you know, closer to the numbers. It's still not there, but it's at least closer. 36.2 over 2. You know, that would be a big thing for them. And that was a clear split the difference between the $42 million and the $30 million that existed between Ramczyk and Conklin. And they'll look at the 3 year, it's 53.75, which again is kind of closer to splitting the difference. Really, the split is what they ended up at. They ended up at 50. That's really the split. So this is a way to kind of paint that a little bit higher. Now, in this terms, a three-year metric, that 3 years is not really guaranteed because that's actually the fourth year of the deal. Yeah, I think that's kind of what we see with right tackle. And now the interesting thing is just that, you know, what happens with the Vikings? What happens with the Colts as you move forward? These are teams that were probably thinking of a different budget, and now you're looking at paying probably $3 to $4 million a year more than they originally thought. I think this one pretty much locks it in. That if you don't offer it, they're not going to take a deal. There's no way that you can paint this one as an outlier. So basically, if you're going to come in under this contract, unless there's some other stuff that's really cool with the deal that, you know, somebody would take, if you're going to come in under this contract, they're not going to take the offer. They'll take their chances in free agency. You know, at the very least, you know you'll probably get Conklin money, which is, you know, your fallback at 14, 5, 15. So I think they'll have an understanding of that, and they'll be able to move forward off there. I do kind of wonder if this will impact the salaries for guards, lesser extent center. Guard has been higher valued. So I would almost think that one of the arguments that you would make if you're representing a guard is, you know, the right tackle market's moved. Obviously, this is just telling us that there's a shift in how much money should be spent on the offensive line. You know, we saw left tackle, you know, get into the 20s. Now we're seeing right tackle get close to 20. And yeah, Tooney got to 16, but hey, we should be 20 as well. Yeah, you know, we shouldn't be lagging, you know, the top contracts that much. So I think that's an interesting one too. And that also is going to impact the Colts, who, you know, have Nelson's deal coming up. I would say I'd be looking at 20 a year, I think, if I'm him. I think that's really what you want to look for, because not only do you want to paint the picture that the position is more important than the right tackle position, you're a great player. But, you know, I'm going to paint that picture that we went from 15 million to 19 million at this position, or 14 to 19, I think, is where we went at this position. I'm going to paint the picture where we went at left tackle, I think was 19 to 23, I think was the jump. So I think logically 16 to 20 is a fair thing to ask for. So that'll be kind of interesting to watch as well to see what happens there. But I think all things being said, I think this is a good deal for the Panthers. I think it's a, when you look at the breakdown of the numbers, I think the logic makes sense. Now, the only thing is you are tying yourself to a left tackle for 3 years for 50. But I think the first 2 years clearly make sense. You know, you knock on wood that he's still effective in that third year. And this is a position, typically, you know, the offensive linemen in general typically do have longer careers. You don't see that kind of drop off where, you know, you might be more worried about a wide receiver or something like that. You know, I think that that's a solid job by them in terms of figuring out a way to get a deal done and structuring it in a way that I guess made them happy and they could spin it in maybe a little bit of a different manner. And you can kind of get those cash flows that are really important to you, you know, to do what you want to do with these, with the deal. That one comes down. And so that was really the only big NFL news of the week. Packers financial statements came out. You saw how much money they lost this year. You know, none of that was a surprise. I don't know why people were making such a big deal of the NFL's national revenues. I mean, that's very predictable. We didn't miss any games last year. So I don't know why it was like a news story that, wow, the league got this much money, you know, $310, you know, per team or something like that in television revenue. Breaking. How's that breaking? I mean, you can look at what the revenue's been for the last couple of years and you can pretty much project where the stuff's going to go. You know, we do that. Yeah, you know, that's part of what goes into some of the projections we made. Yeah, you know, we talked about all that stuff before, you know, during the pandemic, as to where the income sources would come from. Now, I didn't really pay that kind of attention to the local numbers to realize that it's almost like a 50-50 split. And that's where the Packers, you know, that they lost 70% of it or something like that last year, which makes sense. You didn't have fans. So you don't get any of those local revenues in. And I think that the numbers pretty much match up with what I had talked about, which was, if the NFL and the NFLPA did not come to an agreement on the cap last year, we probably would have been looking at a cap of around 155 this year, 150. And that would have been a disaster. That would have been just a catastrophe for the NFL. So I don't know why people are making, you know, that kind of a deal about this. Xavier Howard was back in the news again, where people are talking about his contract. You know, I did a whole thing in detail on the podcast and on OTC on that situation. It's just it was a whiff when they signed the deal, and he doesn't really have a lot of options. Now, I will say this, if he does get traded to another team, I don't think there will be a problem with him getting a raise. You look at DeAndre Hopkins, you know, he got a big new deal. Didn't matter that he had 3 years left. They looked at that and said, you know, we traded for him. We didn't even trade that much. Now, the amount that you trade maybe plays into how much of a raise you'd give, but I think you know that going in. You know, the Rams, they made that trade for Ramsey. They paid him a ton of money to stick around. And they looked at it like, okay, well, yeah, but we did get those two cheap years or cheaper years, you know, in there as well. So for us, you know, that's all part of the process for us in kind of coming up with these contract numbers. We just want to get him signed. We'll do whatever makes him happy because on our books, we look at this a little bit different. You know, if you go back to Antonio Brown being traded to the Raiders, they tweaked his contract to make him happy so he could pretend to be $20 million a year receiver? I don't even remember. What they did was that they didn't consider it a new deal like you would for any other player. They basically said, oh no, this is added money to his old contract. So really, he was always a $20 million a year receiver. It was something nonsensical like that. You know what they did, but that was what they did. So very clearly, there are teams that can do that with him. As for who, you know, you have to look at a team that has to fancy themselves as a contender this year. You know, a team that is very confident that they're going to contend this year, and a team that's probably going to be confident that they're in a position to contend the next 2 years. You know, I think, and now I'm not saying that they're going to trade for him, but, you know, I think if you look at a team like the Chargers, you know, that's the perfect kind of team. You're talking about a young quarterback, And you're talking about a team that has a lot of upside potential, has a lot of cap room, you know, in the future. Those are the kind of teams that make sense, you know, for someone like a Howard. So I think he'll be traded? I would still lean towards no, because I just think Miami has too much control over the situation, and eventually you got to play. You know, the fines are very steep and they're mandatory at this point. So it's not like the old days where you can be all upset with a team and then you kiss and make up and the fines all get waived. That doesn't exist anymore. So I think he'll probably end up sticking in Miami. But yeah, that's, we'll see with him. Jalen Ramsey gave his story about the Jaguars. That was not too interesting. Jaguars are just, they're just kind of a mess, you know, and it's a difficult one there too. It's a family owned team. So you've got family, you've got football executives, you've got a lot of different stuff that comes into play there. And it reminds me a lot of Dallas. And now Dallas, obviously there's a lot more control that's exhibited by Jerry since he runs football ops as well. But it reminds me of situations, you know, Washington probably would have been this way for a long time too, where one person says one thing, another person's thinking something else. You have another person doing whatever, you know, and I think that they just looked at that as a sinking ship. Yeah, it was pretty clear that Coughlin was not well-liked there. Not a surprise. He was... from a different era, you know, the Giants grew to respect him and the way that he was, and he did a good job working with them. But this was a whole new generation of players, and I think it was much harder for him to probably get that group of players on the same page with what he was trying to do to try to mold a team into, I think, being a little bit more professional, you know, and trying to work a bit harder. And, you know, Ramsey, I think, kind of said, there were things that, you know, we were given way too much, you know, latitude before. And now it was just like way too much, at once. You know, it just wasn't a match. You know, Jacksonville, they just need to figure out how to get things right over there. And I think, I don't know how things will be. You know, right now, I think a lot of people are probably not thrilled with some of the stuff that you see with the head coach. I do think that right now the head coach is running the show there. And while that might be a really bad thing, I think it's if they can get back to like a one voice kind of thing versus before where, you know, especially with Coughlin there, it really was three, four voices. You had an owner's voice. You had a general manager who predated Coughlin. Then you had Coughlin. Then you had a coach. You know, you had just too many voices. So maybe things will be a little bit different there now. Only other stuff, let's just take a look real quick at some of the things on OTC this week. All right, let's see here. So through the week, you know, I mentioned I was going to talk about a little bit, never really did, the quarterback and non-quarterback roster spending. So this really was from last week, but just real quick to go over it. If you want to go and take a look, you can look at historical trends with this stuff. And what I did was I plotted how every single team did based on what was the value of their roster, of the top 20 players on their roster, which could include draft picks, and what was the value of the quarterback and how those teams actually performed. What you can see here is I think we can definitely make a little bit of a statement here that spending on the rest of your roster is important. Now, I don't know if we can say exactly what that breakdown might be, but having a quality roster is important. If you look at the breakdown of teams, so those who had a high quarterback value as well as a high non-quarterback value, 30.8, so about 31% of those teams won 10.5, at least 10.5 games. 31% were between 8 and 10 wins. So about 62% there won at least 8 games. And if you look at the QB value being low, which most of the time means a rookie, and high spending on the roster, you basically have a very similar area where we've got, basically right around 63% or so have at least 8 wins. Now, if you split this up actually by 10 wins, the high and high numbers had a little bit better of an outcome, you know, just on the 10 plus wins. But if we drop it down to 8, it's pretty even between the two. Now, the next comparison would be QB value is high, and your roster is low. So you spent below the median numbers or the average numbers. I think I did these by median, but it might be average. 10.5 win seasons drops from 31 to 25. 8 to 10 wins drops from 31 to 26. 5.5 to 7 wins, whatever, who cares about that. But the 0 to 5 win category jumps from 7.5% to 28%. So in theory, you know, those quarterbacks should be of similar, you know, play quality. And the rest of the roster should be the differentiator. Now, it's not all the time because we overpay a lot of quarterbacks, but should be the differentiator. And there's been a difference in performance, especially on the low end. There's a much lower floor, it seems like, with that strategy, and the ceiling might not be as high. The teams like that. And then the worst set of roster construction is the low quarterback value and the low roster value. You know, you're trotting a rookie out there with garbage around him, or you're trotting out there the Ryan Fitzpatricks of the world with garbage around them. Only 8% of those teams actually won more than 10 games. Only 28% of those teams actually had at least 8 wins. 41% of the teams finished with 5 or less wins. You look at that, and I think that that's another one you want to say is you can just look at those teams and say, well, that might not be too good. So if we break down the teams this year into kind of those quadrants, where do we have our highs and our highs? And I know I spoke briefly about this last week. Our high-spending teams in both categories are the Buccaneers, who are the favorites for the Super Bowl, Rams, Titans, Packers, Cowboys, Texans, and say anything about them, and the Chiefs. So those are your teams that fit into that category. Now, the other teams that have high spending on the quarterbacks, but kind of a lower valued roster, are the Falcons, who I think would be a long shot unless the coaching staff really does some funky stuff, which can happen. You know, new face running the team, even when you've got the same team out there, you could have different results. Colts and the Raiders, I would argue that the Colts have a better roster than what their numbers indicate. And by the time the regular season rolls around, those numbers may have changed if they sign players to extensions. Raiders, you know, the Raiders situation, I really think it just boils down to that even in today's, even with so many years gone from the NFL, John Gruden is still a really good head coach, a really great head coach. John Gruden, the general manager, is a catastrophe. He undermines himself as a coach and I know he doesn't have the title of general manager, but he runs the show. And it's a catastrophe because of that. The old style of the league, which let the coach be the GM, was pretty much a colossal failure. You know, Belichick being the exception for a variety of reasons. It's not necessarily his keen eye for free agents or anything else. I just think that they ran a show there that was just pretty smart with a lot of things they did, and his ability as a coach as well as the quarterback, and the fact that they were able to push the salaries down so much kind of covered up a lot of the misses that maybe existed there. But in general, the era of doing that was a mistake. I don't know why you would go back to that with the Raiders, but that's what they did, and I think that's hurt them. Seattle, the Lions, the Vikings, the 49ers, they all fall in that category. Now, the 49ers really should be a low and a low because there's no reason for Garoppolo to still be on this team. You know, Seattle's spot here kind of surprised me. Vikings are in flux, so I don't know. You know, and then when you go to the category of low spending but a higher valued roster, the Bears, the Browns, the Saints, the Cardinals, the Bills, the Patriots, the Giants, the Broncos, and to a lesser extent, the Eagles and the Jaguars. And I think if you're fans of those teams, you got to be happy, right? You've got a young quarterback, you're going for it. You know, you've got Baker Mayfield, you're going for it. You got Kyler Murray, you're going for it. You got Josh Allen, you're going for it. He's a rookie, so it's hard to say with Mac Jones, but you know, you've got whatever there, you're going for it. You've got Drew Locke and Teddy Bridgewater, you're trying to go for it. You got Daniel Jones, you're trying to go for it. So, you know, you kind of like that. Then when you look on the low and the low side here, you got the Ravens. You know, you got Lamar Jackson. Maybe he could do a little bit more. You know, could you do a little more than he had Sammy Watkins? Maybe. You got the Chargers, who are right kind of there. You know, I think the Chargers probably are a team that maybe could have done a little bit more, given that they have a lot of cap room. You know, he's entering year two. You should do whatever you can for the players by year two instead of waiting to see if everything clicks. And in his case, especially, everything really did click last year. But they're right there. You have the Bengals. That's a team that probably should have done more. The Dolphins. I just have a hard feel, you know, for them. Washington, kind of there. The Jets, the Panthers are way low, and then the Steelers are just way down there. So from that quadrant, that's the one you look at and you say, well, I don't know where things are going to be. You know, now the Ravens might do their extension, and so might the Bills, and that'll shift them over into the. You know, the Bills will be a high and a high, and the Ravens would be a high and a low. So maybe you make that exception when you look at them and you say, well, that is kind of a high and a low, which does have a little bit more of an upside to it. You know, and the Ravens would be the team from that little quadrant there that you would expect to do at least 10 wins. You know, Chargers playing a pretty tough division, but I would look at them as having potential for that too. I think I'd be surprised at any of the other teams, Washington, Cincinnati, Miami, the Jets, Pittsburgh, Carolina. I think I'd be surprised if those teams were contenders. But, you know, a lot of those teams end up historically with less than 5 wins. And, gosh, I hope the Jets don't end up with less than 5. I can't see Carolina less than 5, I don't think. Even with the quarterback, maybe they will be. Steelers, you want to say the defense is good enough, but I don't know how long they can do that for. They've done it for like 2 years in a row. You know, Washington is one of those teams. Now, their values could jump up too because they have a couple guys looking for extensions that could jump their values. Dolphins, I'm not very high on. Now, maybe Tua is going to take a big leap forward. I'd be a little worried there, I think. Since he's just a tough call. So anyway, that was just one of the things. We've got, let's see, what else did we do this week? We looked at free agent snaps for next year. That was just to get an idea of, I think more so that sometimes when you start seeing teams that have a lot of snaps that are potentially up for free agency and you look at their salary cap situations, you might say that, you know, those are some of the teams where this is a clear win now mode. And I think if you look at it, now throw the Texans out. Now, the Colts have cap space, so I won't call them a win now. I think when you look at the Chiefs, you look at the Buccaneers, you look at the Vikings, they have a ton of players who are going to be eligible for free agency next year. None of them have more than $20 million in projected cap space. To me, that's a very clear sign that you really want to get far with the rosters that you have. Now, obviously, two of those teams were in the Super Bowl last year. You know, these are teams that probably are going to go through some changes the following year. You know, Washington and Denver both fit in that category. Denver's number is actually much higher than what's here. They had a couple guys who were hurt last year that are expected to be contributors, but they both have cap space. So Washington can re-sign their guys. Denver can re-sign their guys. If the other teams re-sign all their players, and they can, you know, like I said, you can always make the cap do whatever you want in a given year. But if they re-sign their players, it's going to put them in a position where they can't make other signings in the future, you know, and then you just have to focus all on draft at that point. Bills have a pretty high number, and I think the Bills are a team that you look at and say, all right, you know, this is a really important year for them. This is probably, from a lot of ways that you can look at it, this year might be the best on paper roster that they can put out there in terms of free agent signings and their draft picks and everything else, because the complexion of the team is going to change when Allen gets his extension. You know, some other guys start to drop off. You've got the Jets. They have a lot that are up, but that's just because they're kind of in flux. Eagles, yeah, they're really headed nowhere right now. 49ers, you know, and then on the opposite side of the spectrum, you've got the Rams, who don't really have anyone as a free agent. The Saints, who have very few as a free agent. They don't have cap space, either of those teams. So, you know, they're going to have, if these rosters are good, you know, they'll be competing rosters for the next 2 years. The Browns don't have a lot of free agent snaps. That's a pretty cool thing if you're a Cleveland Browns fan. It means that you're really controlling your roster. You don't have cap troubles for the most part. Now, you do have players that are looking for extensions in Mayfield and Chubb, but the Mayfield number is already high for next year. You would bring that down with an extension. Chargers are in great shape. They have very few relevant snaps for free agency and a ton of cap room. Packers, kind of the opposite. Don't have a lot in terms of coming up for free agency, but they're like $31 million over the cap. So anyway, that is just something you can check out. Only other thing we had was the best and worst contracts for the NFC West. I had a very tough time with these. Not the worst ones. I had a tough time with some of the best ones for these teams. This is a division that is kind of hard to get a feel for, I think, right now. So with Arizona was easy, I think, for Chandler Jones to be the best deal that's there. They got him on a really good contract when they signed him. There were a lot of different types of question marks, but he has vastly outplayed that deal. That deal compared to other players is way under market. It's one of the reasons why he's looking for an extension right now, probably will not get it. DeAndre Hopkins was an easy choice for worst. That was just a dumb deal to do. Now, I get they look at it completely different, but whatever. Rams did not have a problem with the best one. That was pretty easy with Andrew Whitworth. I had a hard time actually with them with a worse deal, and that's only because they got rid of all their guys, right? You got rid of your Todd Gurley's and your Cooks and all those other players. So I just looked at Ramsey because the contract structure on that one has already thrown them for a loop to where if he declines at all, they're in a bad position. San Francisco, very easy to choose the worst with Jimmy Garoppolo. That's just a disaster of a deal from day one. I could barely come up with a good deal on the team. And that's hard for me to say because they're such a good front office. I just didn't see anything that stood out to me and be like, wow, you know, that's like really good, like what they did. So that was tough. I had a tough time with Seattle on a best deal as well. You know, Dwayne Brown is the one I ended up going with, but I had a hard time. It was going to be him or like Puna Ford or someone like that. It was like they don't have a lot of bad deals. It's just like nothing really stands out. Lockett stood out, but, you know, he got the new deal. So it was a little harder there. Bobby Wagner, easy choice for worst deal. You know, he did a great job representing himself when he negotiated that contract. Everything works in his favor on that deal. Those are the ones. So we'll be back with a new best worst. I don't know which division. I haven't written it up yet. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. I'll do it during the week at some point. It was completely random, the choice of the West. So I'll just run the little random generator thing that I have, and I'll let it choose a division. It will be an AFC division. We'll start with the AFC, and then I'll do the same division NFC. So we'll see from which of the other three that it'll be. So we'll do that this week. Let me check my email real quick, but I didn't see any email questions this week. So I don't think I got any unless something came in just now. So let me just check. I only put one call on Twitter for questions, so I don't expect too many on that end. Oh yeah, Ted Ginn retired. Nice career. $40.5 million in earnings, give or take a little bit. Never a great player, just a solid kind of role player. Knew what he could do well, embraced doing it, and had an incredibly long career that I don't think most people would have ever projected based on how things went for him in Miami, with the exception of one play where he blew Revis that still people will talk about probably now. If you want to bring up memories of the Jets as to whose fault that play was. Did Kerry Rhodes screw that up, or did Darrell Revis screw it up? But anyway, all right, let's take a look here. All right, Michael says, what is to be made of those Packer financial statements? Not very much. You know, the NFL lost a lot of money last year. Everybody knew they were going to lose a lot of money. You can look at the, you know, if you want to, I mean, you could look at the trends in the television contracts. You could probably get a pretty good idea as to what the national revenues will be this year, because they're still on the old, as far as I know, they're on the old deals. There might be some new kickers in there, but they should be still on the old ones. You would assume that local revenues should be back to the same historical projections. So you throw out this year, you know, you look at those old years, and you should be able to guess as to where they would go. So if they, and I don't have the statements in front of me, so somewhere I have most of their old stuff saved, I think, but I use those just as a rough projection of stuff, but as well as some other things. You can get an idea as to how much the Packers' local numbers grow each year. And I think what you would do is you would simply say, well, this is how much they should have grown in 2020, and so now this is what they should be in 2021. That's assuming that we'll all be, you know, still doing whatever back to normal next year during the football season. Hopefully that'll be the case. I'm still not certain on that, only because I am not one of the crazy COVID whatever people. It's just that I know last year when things were going pretty well in the summer, when the fall turned around, they weren't as good. Now, we learned much better how to deal with it. But it still, you went back, it kind of went backwards a little bit with, I think, what you thought would be and where things actually ended up. So I'm hoping that won't be the case once the fall hits, that we don't go back to that. Hopefully not. But sports-wise, you can't be certain of that, you know, until that hits. Ted says, I know it's the Cowboys, so they're always tied to free agents or big trades, but how impossible would the cap situation be getting either Gilmore or Howard in a big cornerback trade? All right, so Dallas actually is not usually linked to big free agents. Other than the Amari Cooper thing, which was a trade, Dallas really hasn't done a lot of big free agent signings. You know, they did the Greg Hardy one, and I'm sure there's another player or two, but they do a good job of staying out of that. Let's see. You know, the Cowboys would make sense for those players. They only have $5.5 million this year, and they're way over the cap next year. Now, they're going to just redo Dak's deal and get a bunch of cap room. I don't know if they want to do more with their future cap. Let me just look at them here. Yeah, I mean, the DeMarcus Lawrence contract's already a disaster. You know, I guess the question would be, if you wanted to go all in on this, what you would do is you would touch the contract that I think they're afraid to touch, and that's the Amari Cooper deal. I think there's uncertainty as to how long they probably want Amari Cooper on the team. You know, a lot of people are surprised, I think, that they allowed him to test free agency. And then a lot of people look at that as like, it's lucky he came back to them. I don't think Dallas, especially when you look at the structure on that deal, I don't think Dallas was ever going to be, I don't think they were ever crazy about keeping him. I'm not saying that they were against it. Obviously, they weren't. They signed him for $20 million a year. But I don't think they believed that, you know, he was a lock, you know, to be great. And, you know, maybe some of that stems from the Dez Bryant stuff, where Dez Bryant kind of went south. And they didn't pay up for Dez. And they kept some flexibility in there, which allowed them to cut him. But maybe that also plays a role there. But that would be the guy that I think you'd have to restructure if you wanted to make a move. And I would guess if they were going to do that, yeah, the trade deadline is November. They released the date. I forget if it's after week 7 or something. I think you wait, you know, to make those trades. Make sure your team is contending. Make sure your quarterback is healthy. And then you worry about trading. Dan asks, what's the best and worst free agent contract this offseason? All right, let's pull up the deals that were signed this year. I didn't really like the Trent Williams deal. You know, the Leonard Williams deal doesn't have a lot of upside. I wouldn't say that's the worst, though. Galladay's is not a good deal for the Giants, I don't think. You know, now he's older, but the Shaq Barrett deal, I think, is a pretty good deal for the Buccaneers. That's a pretty good one. The worst deals had to be the stuff the Patriots did. You know, the Jonnu Smith, that was terrible. Oh, why can't I think of the receiver's name? The one from the Raiders last year. You know, that was an absolutely awful signing as well. I would say that probably the Jonnu Smith deal, I think, is the worst of free agency. I think that was just no logic in it at all. I thought the Darrell Williams deal, now that was a re-signing in Buffalo. I thought that was a great deal. That was a really good one. The Barrett deal was real good too, and they were both re-signings. So if you were looking at pure free agents, you know, I'm going to throw an oddball one out there. I think Marvin Jones was a really good deal for Jacksonville. It's like a $6 million a year, 6.25, something like that. Fully guaranteed. Well, not fully guaranteed. It's like 3/4 guaranteed. But I thought that was a really good deal. I think the Winston deal is a pretty decent one for New Orleans as well. You know, that's a good one. But, you know, on the big name side, and especially right now when you look at it, I think the Williams deal is terrific. You know, but that Barrett deal also stands out as well. I think those are two of the better deals of the offseason. All right, let's see what Bob has to say here. Looking ahead to 2022, who are some of the potential franchise tag candidates other than players on the tag this year? Oh, boy, that's a good one. All right, let's take a look at free agency for next year. Players who are not on the tag this year. Devontae Adams is a clear franchise candidate, even though they have all kinds of troubles. I don't think Matthew will get tagged. Will Fuller, probably not. Orlando Brown is going to be a tag candidate if he does not get extended. Brian O'Neill will probably be a tag candidate. Dwayne Brown could be. I'm just going through my playing time here. Fred Warner in San Francisco. I think he would be a tag candidate. You know, even though he plays the less important linebacker position, you know, and that salary is driven by the edge rushers. I think he would be good enough to where they would do that anyway. See, TJ Watt, you know, that I would imagine something will get done, but you know, TJ Watt would be somebody, clearly. you know, he's never going to hit market. I'm sure I'm missing a couple other guys here. I just have my giant list up. You know, Jamal Adams, if Brown, you know, you've got the two guys there with Brown and Jamal Adams, I would guess. You know, I didn't throw Voids in there. Throw those in there as well. Those players are also eligible. You know, for some reason, there's a lot of people that think you can't tag like a player on a void. I don't really get that one. You know, you're allowed in the CBA like a futures tag, which basically is to cover players who run those void deals. So I don't really get that. Let's run through by teams. Bengals have a safety who's coming up. Bates. Yeah, that might be an interesting one. He could be a tag candidate. Yeah, so some of those guys, you know, I'd have to go through like a whole bunch of things. I have the wrong stuff kind of up, I think, for that right now. But those would be some of the guys that I think will be tag candidates. C Family says, is Justin Herbert a legit dark horse MVP? I don't think he would be a dark horse MVP. He was so good as a rookie that I'm not sure that people would say that he would be a dark horse to win MVP. Now, I haven't looked at the odds. You know, to me, a dark horse to win MVP is, you know, someone like a Winston or a Taysom Hill, you know, guys who I don't think were really projected to do much. You know, someone like Ryan Fitzpatrick ain't ever going to win. But, you know, Daniel Jones would be like a dark horse MVP or something like that. I don't think people would be shocked if he somehow had a good enough year to do that. What contracts can Dallas redo to free up cap space and not hurt the next few years? You know, really, it's Amari Cooper. Is it going to hurt? It's going to hurt if he, like, stinks. But that's it. You know, now, if you're talking about next year, you've got Dak as well. But for this year, I mean, you're looking at Cooper. He's got a $20 million P5, which means you've got a lot of money you can prorate there. Everybody else is low, you know, other than Lawrence. Lawrence got 17, and they're not going to – well, they shouldn't touch him again. It's like his contracts have become a mess. But you look at these other salaries, Zeke 9.6, Martin 1.6, Smith 7.2, other Smith 1.6, Collins 1.5, Brown 4.3, Jarwin 3.5. You don't – there's no paragraph 5 salaries to get cap relief from. Cooper's the only guy. Now, if you look at the future, you still run into the same problems with Lawrence and that the contract's already an albatross. But you've got Dak with a 20 P5 that you can bring down, that you will bring down. Martin's at 11.8, so, I mean, you could do a little bit there. Smith, again, is at 13.5. They do him all the time. Tyron Smith, not Jalen Smith. You know, so you can bring him down for some cap relief. Collins, I think you'd be afraid of. And then you look at the rest of the roster, there's just nothing there. So, I mean, really, it's Amari Cooper. Amari Cooper is the guy. I mean, Dallas would be in a better position with their cap if they needed to do stuff. And I don't know if they really need to do anything. They would be in a better position with their salary cap if they went in there and they tinkered with that contract. But, you know, they have free agent coming up at the position. Maybe they want to keep their options open. You know, do you sign him and do you let Cooper go? Do you trade Cooper away? It's very affordable on the cap right now to trade Cooper. So, you know, they may look at it, you know, from that perspective. You know, you drafted a wide receiver. You've got another young wide receiver that you like. You think you can sign him to a more affordable extension, you know, that, and he'll be productive for longer, you would think, maybe than Cooper. Maybe that's part of their logic for why they haven't touched the contract. But Cooper's the guy that would be reasonable still, I think, on the cap. Even if they tinkered with his deal, I think they're hesitant for whatever reasons, a couple reasons. Let's see. Mark says, is Xavien Howard's value for trade, keeping in mind the knee injuries, but the all-pro abilities? You know, and I think you also have to keep in mind that he's going to look for a raise. So, I mean, that's part of it as well. So I think, if you're going to enter into a trade discussion with Miami, I think the first thing that you have to do is you have to get permission to speak with Howard's agents to see, okay, what kind of contract does this kid want if he wants to play here? Because there's a big difference in doing what I talked about with the Brown deal, where you take the money that was there from Miami and you turn that into a $20 million a year contract. So for example, let me pull him up. If we use Miami's old numbers in there, Howard's deal it's worth 75 over 5. Miami has already paid out 25 or so of that. You would be looking at that and say, okay, if, and I'm just throwing the $20 million a year number out there. I'm not sure if that's really the number. I think that's really pushing it, but you never know. You know, so for a team acquiring him right now, you'd be looking at 4 years remaining at $12.3 million a year. That's what's on his contract right now. Let's say that you needed to add 25 to that. That would bring your investment in him to 18.6. So I think if that's what he would be looking for, I'm going to say a second round pick. That's probably what that would be. Now, it's trickier if he's just looking for a brand new deal. Because if he's just looking for a brand new deal where you've got 49.325 in there, essentially really what he's looking for is 100 over 5. That's a monstrous commitment that you would have to make, you know, to get a deal done, because you'd be guaranteeing everything. I'm just talking about this other stuff where you're just throwing some extra money in there and, you know, maybe you guarantee 1 year. You're not really doing anything out of the ordinary with it. So I think if that's the kind of deal, you know, that then I think you're looking more conditional second, where you'd probably start lower and then it depends on the results. And, you know, that can be the thing with a lot of these trades. I always love conditional trades. I like stuff that's based on teams making playoffs and playing time to go along with that and stuff like that. You know, whether that's to escalate from a 2-1 or a 3-2. I would just think with all the contract stuff and the fact that Miami doesn't have a lot of leverage, I'm not really sure why you would give Miami a first round pick, but it certainly wouldn't be any more than that. You know, that they can ask for the Jamal Adams thing, Jalen Ramsey deal, but they're very different situations. That situation is only valid if Howard is willing to play the next 4 years at $12.3 million. Ain't gonna be. But if he was, yeah, then there's a lot of value in that. But otherwise, there's not, because you're not getting those two rookie years like Seattle got with Adams or the Rams get with Ramsey. You know, you're buying into a contract that exists already and being asked to rip it up as if he was a free agent and do that. So I don't think that would happen. So I would think the max value is a 1, but I would lean more towards a 2 with a possibility to jump up based on how things go, you know, this year. John says, what veterans can be capped casualties? Ooh, that's a good one. You know, I think you're basically looking at certain teams more so than anything else. You look at a team like the Hitchens, to me, that would make sense for the Chiefs. Somebody that maybe would go. Giants don't really have cap space. I don't think they have anyone that stands out there. Philadelphia would probably be Zach Ertz if they can't come up with a trade. I don't know if they really want to keep him. You know, if they can't come up with a trade, it probably makes more sense for them to move on. Raiders, Jalen Richard, probably not. Quentin Jefferson, probably not. Bears. Well, I don't know why they haven't moved Jimmy Graham yet, but I wonder what the Bears are thinking about Hicks. I wonder if they'd look to trade him. I don't think they would cut him. I wonder if they would look to trade him. Any other teams? Maybe the Bills? You know, Jerry Hughes is probably on his last legs. You know, they'd save up some money. I know the Beasley's been rumored. I think that's more, you know, obviously he had his Twitter rants and whatever, but I feel like the Beasley rumors are more people pushing stuff onto them than, I don't know, actual behind the scenes kind of stuff, unless people were that upset by stuff that he was saying within the organization. And maybe they were, but I don't know. I don't feel like that's the case. Punter and with the Rams, Pittsburgh, they've already done their house cleaning, so I don't see that. Minnesota, probably not here either. Yeah, I guess those are the players. You know, and there's a lot of other guys, but I don't think a lot's going to be driven too much by cap this year. I think teams have got it kind of sorted out, so I don't think we'll get that. I think that's it for me tonight. Hopefully I'll be back next week. Hopefully maybe we'll have some NFL news, but I doubt it. So if you have any interesting topics that you want me to cover next week, let me know. I'll try to write up some stuff on that. Otherwise, I'll see whatever kind of floats the boat with some of the stuff that I write about this week, and you know, anything that pops into my head to babble about next week. So, Nelly, you got anything before we go? Nothing. So, anyway, everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.